Farmers have long been told of the challenge they face to feed increasing global populations, with an expected 9 billion on the planet by 2050. Now the World Bank Group is warning climate change is intensifying the threats farmers were already dealing with, and a business-as-usual approach to agriculture is not an option. The Aid and Development Group's Special Envoy for Climate Change, Rachel Kite, was in Australia recently for a summit on food security. She says extreme weather events are already having a significant effect on the amount of food we produce.
Climate change is going to make what's already a difficult sort of planning process just all the more complicated. Farmers are going to have to find ways to build resilience into their farming methods. And at the same time, 30% of all emissions come from the way in which we manage land, including agricultural practices. So we're going to have to change our agricultural practices to reduce the emissions that are coming from the way in which we manage the land.
You talk about the role of farmers and also that point on emissions from agriculture. What role, I guess, does Australia and Australian farmers have to play in feeding growing global populations and doing so in those challenging circumstances?
Australia's got this really long and extraordinarily proud tradition, I think, of scientific research in agriculture, and certainly as part of the global body of publicly funded research, the Consultative Groups on International Agricultural Research, Australia plays a key role. And it's through that kind of research in past decades that we've been able to provide the rice varieties, the wheat varieties and the corn varieties, as well as breakthroughs in other crops that have allowed us to be able to feed the growing developing world population today. And so the research community is doubling down now, trying to work out how we are going to build resilience into agricultural systems so that we can feed even more people on less land with less water under extremely volatile weather. So I think that this is a key role for Australia in the world.
You talk about sort of a business-as-usual approach to agriculture no longer being an option. How does it need to change and how quickly does it need to change? And I guess where are the opportunities?
Well, I think it's location-specific because, you know, if you're a rice farmer in the delta of the Mekong, then you've got one set of challenges. If you are growing wheat in the plains and steppes of Russia, you've got another set of challenges. The point being that what you are used to is not going to be what you're farming into. And the past is no longer a predictor of the future. So there is a responsibility to get really good evidence and data about what's going to be happening to the weather, what's going to be happening to the soil. We need techniques and inputs that will allow us to increase yields, have those yields be highly nutritious, and be able to do that with much less water. At the same time, the nitrogen cycle is the same today as it was 40, 50 years ago. And you think of the kinds of innovative breakthroughs we've had in science and technology in other areas, trying to be able to produce the world's food with less nitrogen being inputted, given the impact of nitrogen on climate change, remains one of the sort of big breakthroughs that we would need to see in global agriculture.
One of the things you talked about was people having overnutrition, and also, I guess, food wastage is something that we often hear about. Do we need to value food more and value farming more?
I think that food is actually one way in which to relate individual people to this sort of global challenge of climate change, in that often people feel very disempowered by something which seems to be so distant, it's in the atmosphere, and what do I do? What can I do tomorrow that would make a difference? Food becomes a great connector in that it is about the choices that we make. It's about the choices we make to throw food away, to buy food that we never use. It's about the choices we make in terms of how much meat we have in our diet, and the choices we make in terms of how we support farming communities and how we support agriculture at home and then abroad. So I think food is a very important and emotional way in which to connect individuals to the problem of climate change. And hopefully, as we start talking more about needing to reduce waste and needing to be able to provide nutritious food for those who don't have it, and nutritious food for those people who are eating too much of the wrong stuff, we can find a way to put farmers back at the heart of what is one of the greatest moral challenges this generation faces.
And that's the World Bank Group's Special Envoy for Climate Change, Rachel Kite, speaking with Kath McAloon. Well, most of you would be familiar with Goulburn Valley pears, Sunraysia dried fruit, or Riverina citrus. The food we eat is often synonymous with the region in which it's produced. Most of the time, it's because the weather and soils combine to be perfect for growing a particular food type. But will it stay that way? Our reporter Warwick Long spoke to two researchers who've been looking at how a changing climate affects how trees grow. Dr. Rebecca Derbyshire from Melbourne University and Dr. Catherine Pope from the University of California specialise in chill, a phenomenon where fruit trees need to get cold in winter if they're to grow their produce. And Dr. Pope says things are already changing.
Things are getting warmer in California just as they are here in Australia. So what I've been working on is essentially a vulnerability assessment of what is going to be in trouble first. Are we seeing any effects of warming already? And when can we expect that trouble to really come for what crops in what order? So in other words, like, what should we worry about first? What should we work on first? And what we found is that some of the crops with higher chilling requirements that we grow in California, like cherries and walnuts and prunes, are already starting to respond to warming in the sort of timing of their spring behavior. We think that they should be pretty safe for the next coming decades, but those are definitely the crops that we have our eye on most for those that need to be expecting some impact of warmer winters and starting to plan for breeding and different sprays that they might be able to use to adapt to that.
Just how vulnerable are these higher chill varieties to this change that's happening at the moment?
Well, so things haven't gotten quite warm enough in general for them to be very vulnerable. This year in California, we sort of had a double whammy of warm winter, so low chill, and then warm spring at bloom for our cherry crops and our prune crop. And so that hit us pretty hard. And sort of in a triple whammy, you could say, of also decreased water because of a drought we're experiencing. So this year, though, every sort of 20 or 30 years, we have a warm winter. This year has been that combination of all the things that we could expect to go wrong as climate change progresses. So it's been an interesting sort of shot across the bow of heads up, guys. You know, it's not going to be this way every year for the rest of the coming decades, but it's going to get more and more frequently like this.
And you mentioned that serious changes mightn't affect these crops for decades in terms of their viability in a given area. How important is it to be looking at these things now, given that the major effects could be decades away?
Oh, it's really important. Well, because in tree crops, the breeding, nut crops and fruit crops, breeding just takes a lot longer than it does to come out with a new variety for, you know, wheat, say, or those sort of field crops, because it takes so long for a tree to grow into production, into prime production. So when you do that first cross of, you know, we like this one for its color and we like this one for its flavor, let's see what happens, you need 10 to 15 years to see how the kids out of that cross also perform in terms of yield and tree structure and that sort of thing. That takes 3 decades or more. So it's important that we start paying attention to this pretty soon and taking action pretty soon.
Dr. Rebecca Derbyshire, you've done similar work here, but for different types of fruit.
Yeah, so we've been looking more closely at apples and pears, so palm fruit here in Australia, and thinking along the same lines as Catherine. So these trees also require winter chill in order to produce normal fruit. And we've had a look at flowering patterns as well, but we haven't seen much of a trend yet, which may be because we don't have as long records, so it's difficult to see what's going on. But yeah, there hasn't been a huge climate signal.
Australia can be a country of a continent of such extreme climate too. Does that mean there could be some resilience in what we have here compared to, say, a more stable climate like California?
Yeah, I mean, that we do experience a lot of extremes. In particular, you can think of water, like a lot of droughts, and we do have a lot of hot weather. I think the resilience probably lies more so in the growers. You know, they're accustomed to these sorts of circumstances. But I think, as with the Californian experience, when a few of these line up together, that's when it starts getting difficult to manage. So if you get a low chill and a high summer heat, which can damage fruit, as we saw earlier this year with all those high degree days, you know, then that starts to compound your profitability.
We're speaking to Dr. Catherine Pope from the University of California, who has the American accent, and Dr. Rebecca Derbyshire from the University of Melbourne. They've both looked at the effects of climate change on chill which is where fruit and nut trees need to get and stay cold for a certain period each winter in order to set large amounts of fruit to grow in spring. And is that one of the hard things too, is there's a lot of unknowns, as Rebecca just mentioned before, in terms of the climate and the tree science, so putting it all together can be quite a difficult picture to paint.
Yeah, I definitely say that's true. I mean, we have our estimates of what the chilling requirements for these crops are just sort of based on, you know, in California we started growing a lot of tree crops in the 30s and 40s when we were really settling into horticulture, and they just brought a bunch of varieties over from the East and the Midwest and saw what grew and saw what didn't and just kept growing the ones that did all right. And that was fine because conditions were the same decade after decade. But as things change, you know, we don't really totally know how much cold they need. So, you know, trees in some ways are a lot smarter than we are, and it's hard. They're like great at calculus, apparently. It's really hard to figure out how they're counting the cold. It's not too straightforward.
So what is still needed to be known over the coming decades as these effects start to be seen? What are the important things to be looking at that you want to be looking at?
Well, I would say, oh gosh, so many things. Yeah, we need to get a better grapple on how these trees are counting chill so that we can be better at knowing which varieties and which crops are most vulnerable. And that's, I would say, the most immediate concern. And then in the sort of medium term, you know, there's the so what. Like, okay, you can tell me that these cherries aren't going to grow here in 40 years. What do I do about it, you know, from a grower perspective? So,
But we really also need to not only just understand how the trees are calculating this chill, but, you know, some of what Catherine's looked at, well, how does that really impact yield? You know, so we can say, well, it doesn't look like what it used to look like, but what's the impact on yield in the end? And then also, as mentioned, what can we do about it to improve the situation?
Mm-hmm. There's those two angles that you can go. You can come up with strategies to deal with it with the trees that you've got, or if you know more about the trees, you can breed trees that'll be more resilient.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. I mean, you know, our tree crops are in the ground for 20 to 30 years. And so the trees that are going in right now, the trees that growers have to plant in the next couple of decades, what's on the market, are not probably, for in some areas, going to be able to make it through 40, 50 years from now. You know, their hands are tied. They've got to plant what we have now. So how can we help them get through for that medium range?
And we heard from Dr. Catherine Pope from the University of California and Dr. Rebecca Derbyshire from the University of Melbourne. Well, it seems Australia is falling behind when it comes to turning agricultural waste into heat and electricity, according to an international bioenergy organisation. Overseas, more and more farmers are converting straw and stubble into other products rather than just burning it off in the paddock. Andrew Lang is a farmer from southwest Victoria and a board member with the World Bioenergy Association.
Sweden's really interesting because they are getting now over 50% of their energy from renewable sources. That includes heat and transport fuels as well as electricity. And about 39-40% of that is from biomass, mostly out of the timber industry and timber industry processing, including paper making. But when you're driving around or going by train in Sweden, you go through any city like Horsham or Hamilton would be a good example. They would always, somewhere there'll be a decent chimney, and at the bottom of that will be a biomass to energy plant, maybe either just heat or for heat and electricity. Sometimes it's municipal waste, sorted municipal waste, so, you know, everything from dirty nappies to sheet plastic to PET bottles maybe, but more often than not it'll be some sort of timber industry residues out of their local forestry industry.
So if we come back home to Western Victoria, what are we seeing in that space throughout this part of the world?
The only thing we're seeing is a little wood chip fueled heating plant at Beaufort Hospital, where Beaufort Hospital had been spending something like $60,000-$80,000 a year on LPG for heating the whole hospital complex, including laundry and kitchen water. And now that's been replaced by a small wood chip fueled Austrian made little heating system that super automatic, very sophisticated, no smoke, that has dropped their heating costs to about $20,000 a year. Comes from the local sawmill, keeps all that money in the community.
So in a simplistic form, when we talk about biomass and bioenergy, what are we talking about?
Biomass is every sort of material of biological origin, from human sewage, animal manures, through manure, through straw, through plantation harvest residues and all of that food residue and other, you know, supermarket outdated foods, perishable foods, all of that comes under the heading of biomass, including what comes out as landfill gas or sewage gas. And so it's a very broad area. A whole lot of technologies are involved there in producing heat, electricity and transport fuels out of those. So for some reason, bioenergy doesn't get talked about in Australia, even though it is the dominant renewable energy source, mostly as heat, mostly as domestic heat.
And so what scope do you see then throughout these parts where we could really tap into it?
The other day I got a call from a guy at Streatham who's part of a cropping group towards Ballarat, and he was saying in their area they are betting that burning stubbles is going to be illegal within a few years, just not allowed, partly because of all the stubble fires they've been having there over the last few years. And so they are working on all of the options for what to do with harvest trash coming out of the back of the header full of weed seeds, and they're looking at baling it directly, and then they're thinking, what the hell are we going to do with it? And if they're in half of these overseas countries, particularly in the EU or China or India, they would be using that straw for energy one way or the other. There's a crowd in WA who are turning it into biochar. There's someone else I've come across who claims to be able to turn it straight into diesel, and I'm a bit sceptical about that one. But there's a big market in pellets for bedding for racehorses in that racing industry, where I've heard that we're importing about $1 million a year of straw pellets from, I don't know, Europe or the US. And, you know, that is simply nuts. We could easily be making that sort of stuff here. And so there are a number of things. You can turn straw directly into ethanol. You can use it for heat and electricity. You can use it just for heat and very small scale. And so it's a matter of what the economics of all of that are here.
And Andrew Lang was speaking with Brett Worthington.